And you know what? Your first learned society is always like the learned society that you love the most. So it's very exciting in later life to be able to come back and be right at the heart of it again. So let me get going on the paper. My focus for the paper is a paper of Natalie Duddington's from the Aristotelian Society, 1918 to 1919. I'm excited to be able to go back and look at her text. I also had a little bit of, I wanted a quote from a famous paper from the Aristotelian Society by Austin. And this is just my sort of warning to you all. So this is Austin. I feel ruefully sure also that one must be at least one sort of fool to rush in over ground so well trodden by the angels, as he gave his paper on other minds. So I feel ruefully sure that I am also one kind of fool, but here we go. General skepticism raises a philosophical worry, well, about everything. My focus, though, is on the problem of other minds specifically. I will assume that I'm a subject in a material world that exists and which I could know. There are tables, chairs, seas, and pebbles, and I can know that. My question is a question about my being in a world with other subjects. How do I know they exist? Skepticism about others is a particularly nightmarish cul-de-sac for philosophical reflection to take us. It's heart-wrenching, horrific, to think that one's family could not be real. Even if it can be assumed that we're in a world of objects, that we're not alone in that world, matters to us more than anything else matters to us. There's a particular kind of anxiety we experience when the skeptic about other minds, the solipsist about persons, I'll call him, induces a worry that our acceptance that we have our lives along with others is unfounded or inexplicable. When the solipsist says, you know you exist, you know your own thoughts and feelings, I don't dispute that. However, no grounds are available to you for thinking that those moving bodies of others, what you call your children, for example, are subjects with minds. For all you know, you are alone, and they are merely moving lumps of matter. When they say that, their challenge comes not only as a theoretical one, but as a form of emotional anxiety or disturbance. We feel unwilling to countenance the possibility and are disturbed by being asked to do so. The problem of other minds strikes us with a kind of emotional weight that's not typical of philosophical problems in general. Before turning to how we might address our problem, however, let me note that my focus is not on the mere possibility of error or deception. I don't take the solipsist challenge to be constituted by a mere logical possibility that my two children have been replaced by sophisticated cybernauts. If that were all it was, I could assure myself, with enough Oxford philosophy, that a mere logical possibility does not by itself undermine my ability to know. My concern is a concern with what resources I have for knowing that there are others. Is my actual relation to others, in fact, no different from the way I would relate to a world of merely moving matter? It's when one turns to the question, how do we know, that one gets a bit queasy. Fortunately, given the occasion, I want to use a paper of Natalie Duddington's from the Aristotelian Society, 1918 to 1919. Duddington's paper hasn't been altogether neglected, but those who've written about it have tended to take her merely as an exemplar of a perceptual approach to other minds. My central motive for taking up Duddington's paper is that it offers two distinctive and underexplored insights into how we relate to others. She presents a forthright and compelling case for a perceptual approach to other minds, but it's a particular version of a perceptual approach that focuses on the actions of animate beings. The idea that we know each other as animate beings is one that rarely figures in discussions of other minds. Good thing I'm not using a PowerPoint. And is one I want to explore. However, Duddington's discussion also shows a striking sensitivity to the kinds of stakes at issue, bringing out ways in which we stand to be affected by others in knowing them and what we lose in not. Duddington frames her discussion of with a distinction between knowing the existence of another mind and knowing what that mind is thinking or feeling. Quotes, "The recognition of the existence of another mental life could be expressed by the judgment, this is a living being. We immediately perceive the presence of a mind, but we often fail to discern anything further with regard to it. We are directly aware that the fellow creatures we meet in the street are human beings and not walking mannequins, but we hardly see more than this." Close quotes. Duddington's object is to maintain that our knowledge of other minds is as direct and immediate as our knowledge of physical things. But in something of a reversal from the usual way of proceeding, she emphasizes the centrality of recognizing the existence of another person in contrast to the task of discerning what the person is thinking or feeling. And she emphasizes, and I think this is important, she emphasizes the extent to which we can stand in a knowing relation to another while being largely ignorant of what's going on in their minds. Quote, "Perceiving a mind certainly does not lay before us all its thoughts, feelings, and wishes, and so on. But neither does perceiving a table reveal to us the atoms and molecules that compose it." According to Duddington, we can come to know the existence of others directly and early on in our development. The way we're presented with other animated bodies already reveals the existence of a mental life in human beings in contrast to inanimate objects. "We do not first know bodies and then infer," this is her, "we do not first know bodies and then infer that they are animated bodies. The presence of mental life is revealed to us along with the qualities of shape, color, movement, and so on that characterize the body. This does not imply anything so absurd as the assertion that a six-month-old baby knows its mother's mind as distinct from her body, but it does imply that insofar as it's aware of its mother at all, it's aware of her as qualitatively different from the perambulator she's pushing." So following Duddington, we can either ask, how do we know there are others at all, or how do we know the mental life of another? And my focus today will be on the first question. Also following Duddington, I take our knowledge of the existence of others to be direct and immediate. The mental life of the other is revealed to me as independent and given. Duddington's story leaves somewhat explained, however, why, in particular, in seeing animated bodies, we see minds. I'm going to seek to clarify why that might be. However, I'm also going to adapt Duddington in another direction by suggesting that her treatment of our relation to others, in fact, points us to a vital non-perceptual resource for knowing others' minds. Moreover, this resource both helps us make sense of the kind of knowledge of others we care so much about, and is of a kind that can show that introspection, I'll argue, can play a role in helping us diffuse our solipsistic anxiety. So that's my problem. Section two, perception of others. Attempts to argue that other minds are known through introspection with some form of probable inference have rarely been found convincing. Few think that Mill's question, by what evidence do I know and by what considerations am I led to believe that the walking and speaking figures which I see and hear have sensations and thoughts, or in other words, possess minds with a capital M. Few people think that question is well answered by Mill's answer. They have bodies like mine that exhibit acts and outward signs, and in my own case, I know them to be caused by feelings. Duddington declares this suggestion a ridiculous one. Quotes, a child of two attaches intelligible meaning to the phrases mother is angry, mother is pleased, and correctly interprets her expressive behaviour. Are we to assume then that at that tender age the child has already observed its own feelings of anger and pleasure, its own expression of these feelings, and has compared the angry tone of its mother's voice or her smile with the sound of its own little voice when angry and the look on its own face when pleased? This is such a ridiculous supposition that no wonder psychologists do not like being questioned too closely as to the age at which we're supposed to make the momentous inference that saves us from being solipsists. Apart from her decisive, almost spicy dismissal of the idea that we could possibly come to know other minds by inference from self-observations, she makes a connection between how we know others and what enables us to care about them. If we stood to other minds in the way suggested by Mill, the effective nature of our connection to others would be unintelligible. Here's a quote. Human affections would not be there to frustrate the demands of logic if it were true that other minds for us were merely inferred entities. How could one love or hate in uncertain supposition of we know not what? How then do we know that the other is minded in a way that makes human affection intelligible, if not by introspection and probable inference? Her answer is direct perceptual acquaintance. When we are confronted with the complex reality that we call a human being, we may be as directly and as immediately aware of the mental as of the physical aspect of it. And how, for Duddington, does our perceptual relation to the other get taken up by the perceiver? Quotes, the look of misery in a fellow's face wrings my heart with pity, just because it is his suffering that's revealed to me, and no amount of sophistication will hide it from me. The pain of someone you love seems to blot out the rest of the world from your view. The experience of the perceiver and her world can be utterly transformed by the experience of the other. It can wring her body and occlude her world. The effective response in the perceiver is, moreover, introspectable. Quote, it's possible to distinguish by introspection between one's awareness of someone else's pain and the pain which one feels oneself because of it. Close quotes. Duddington's discussion raises, for me, at least the following questions. First, how should we make sense of our capacity to recognize this is a living being? I want to suggest that we can provide an answer if we explicitly include the overt actions, the speakings, the walkings, the lookings, as well as other facial and bodily movings of humans as perceivable mental phenomena. Second question, why, if the mental is perceivable, is it so commonly thought that perception leaves something out? And the third question, how might Duddington make sense of the fact that perception of others enables one to love or hate them when an inference to an uncertain supposition of we know not what cannot? So let me start with the first question. As we saw, according to Duddington, we perceptually recognize animate bodies. How? The obvious answer is that in perceiving an animated body, we perceive overt mental phenomena. What mental phenomena might we include in that category? Suppose, and I've argued, that overt human actions are psychological occurrences taking place in the life of a human mind. If that was the case, an epistemically straightforward way of securing direct knowledge of others' minds would be to argue that we perceive others' actions as such. If actions are mental phenomena, and if we directly perceive actions, we can conclude that we directly perceive minds in action. And we do perceive action as such. Most of the visible movements of a human animal are recognized as actions of the other by the perceiver. You can hear and speak, see me now talking to you. That feels like a non-contentious idea. On this way of looking at things, when Mill asks, by what evidence do I know that the walking and speaking figures which I see and hear possess minds, he's already answered his own question. Seeing and hearing the walking and speaking of figures is already to perceive their minds. We may still ask how we know their covert, unexpressed thoughts and feelings, but our answer to the question as how we know that they are minded at all has already been given. Duddington emphasizes two aspects of our basic awareness of the existence of others, that they're human beings and that they're animated. And for her, quotes, the differentia of responsive or animate objects as compared with inanimate is just the presence of psychical life. So the view of human animal as mental would, if justified, enable us to meet the demands of the existence question. When we see animated human beings, we say we see their minds in action. On the metaphysics of mind suggested, much of our mental lives is perceivable, and a perceptual approach to the problem of other minds provides a robust response to the question of how we can know them. It also, importantly, provides an explanation of our ignorance of other minds. We very often do not know what's going on in the covert life of another beyond that they're standing or walking. Sometimes we know that a person thinks something. They say it out loud, for example. But we wonder why, and wonder what they're doing in telling us, and wonder how they feel about this thing that they think. To make progress on such inquiries, we'll need to make inferences, try to get them to say more or do more, so that we either have direct knowledge or more to base our inferences and conjectures on. So I take the solipsist about persons to be wrong when they suggest that perceiving animated others cannot give us direct grounds to believe they are minded rather than merely moving matter. However, this is not in the end the strategy I want to focus on. I think the solipsist challenge and the difficulty it imposes brings out a way in which only appeals only to perception do leave something out and leave out the materials that enable us to resist it. Moreover, to say no more than that we can perceive others' minds does not naturally give us the materials with which to tackle the two further questions we posed above when trying to understand Duddington's view. Why is it so commonly thought that perception does leave something out? And how should we make sense of perception of others playing a role enabling us to love and to hate them? A common way of spelling out the mere perception leaves something out is a failure of sufficiency claim. It can seem that the very possibility that the skeptic can sow doubt about our ability, about our knowledge of others, while leaving in place our capacities to perceive the rest of the material world, the chairs and the tables, the seas and the pebbles, indicates that perceiving others is not sufficient to know them to be minded. This possibility can make Noam Eyalon's claim that, quote, no amount of perception on its own implicates awareness of another first-person perspective, another eye, seem unavoidable. Now, on the way of thinking about perception and its objects I've been working with, we have no reason to take the perceptual life of a subject in a sole subject universe to be the same as ours in ours. But it doesn't offer the skeptic much if he does not agree with my way of thinking, and my way of thinking does have hefty theoretical commitments. However, there's another way of spelling out the mere perception leaves something out thought. We might say that although perception can enable us to know the minds of others, there are further fundamental ways of knowing others that are non-perceptual. When we appeal only to perception as a way of relating to others, something has indeed been left out. And indeed, what has been left out is what, what has been left out makes the thought of them not existing disturbing, and I'm going to argue, in the end, unthinkable. Richard Moran says in his discussion of Sartre on The Look the following, quote, a solution to the problem of other minds that tells me that contrary to first appearances, the behavioral evidence I encounter in the outside world really is sufficient for an extremely probable inference to the sentience of others, could still seem unsatisfying for at least two reasons. It seems to be a distortion of my actual relations to other people to characterize them as based on a very probable inference to their sentience. Rather, I experience my relation to others as somehow more immediate or more engaged than that. And I normally hope that their own relations to me are similarly immediate or engaged. Secondly, the idea that a form of inference to the best explanation could be a satisfying response to solipsism loses touch with the Cartesian starting point that set the terms of the problem. We began with a sense of disparity between the indubitability that I'm presented with in the cogito and what I can be presented with in the experience of other creatures around me. But the perceptual account inspired by Duddington does not involve inference, and the other is not only extremely probable. I am directly and immediately aware of the other, and elements of their aware of the other. They are revealed to me in perception. Moreover, Duddington takes the kind of perceptual acquaintance involved to offer engagement. It's hard not to read Duddington as committed to the thought that one way in which the subject knows the other, as she puts it, obtrusively standing over and against her, is that in perceiving the other, she's liable to undergo an affective response, the heart-wringing pity, the blotting out of the rest of the world. There's no retreat into the sureness of her own existence that does not stand to be matched by the sureness of the others. Finally, the affective experiences of the subject are distinguishable by introspection from similar experiences in her own mind. However, Duddington appeals only to perception. She offers no explicit role to our affective capacities in her official account of our knowledge of others. I want to take her account where I think it leads and suggest we should consider also our affective capacities and relations to each other as central to what it is to know another. Duddington's account leaves us room to wonder whether she takes the emotional responses she describes to play any direct role in our knowledge of others, and whether she takes perceptual knowledge of others as a kind of knowledge one could have with no affective engagement with the other. In the film The Lives of Others, the character Captain Gerd Wiesler spies on his downstairs neighbours. He has perceptual access to them and their doings. They do not even know of his existence. And at the start, interestingly, only at the start, he has no interest in theirs. We can ask, would a perceiver stuck permanently in a people-watching hide with the other ignorant of their existence, perceiving with a detached, disinterested attitude to the other, stand in the same knowing relations as we do to others? Section 3, non-perceptual sources. As I said at the start, I want to take Duddington's discussion in two directions. First, I wanted to clarify why we might think that perceiving animated bodies involves us perceiving minds. I take myself to have done that in the claim that the actions of others we perceive, the walkings, talkings, speakings, cryings, frownings, are themselves occurrences in the psychological life of the animal. Second, I wanted to suggest that Duddington directs us to effective, non-perceptual resources for knowing others, and argue that these resources provide the kind of knowledge of others we care about and are also able to help the reflective subject diffuse her solipsistic worries. Naomi Alan, in a recent 2025 paper, quotes a wonderful passage from Broad on our belief in the existence of other minds. This is Broad. It would seem then that we have a stronger belief in the existence of other minds than in the existence of material things. No one in his senses doubts either proposition in practice. But the philosopher can and does doubt the latter in his study. Whilst even in that chaste seclusion, he seems unable or unwilling to doubt the former. I do not think that this difference can be ascribed either to the fact that the evidence for the existence of other minds is more cogent than the evidence for the existence of matter, or to the fact that we have a stronger instinctive belief in the former than in the latter. I think that the real explanation is that certain strong emotions are bound up with the belief in other minds, and that no very strong emotions are bound up with the belief in matter. The position of a philosopher with no one but himself to lecture to and no hope of an audience would be so tragic that the human mind naturally shrinks from contemplating such a possibility. It is our business, however, to stifle our emotions for the present and to follow the argument whithersoever, I love a whithersoever, it may lead. Broad's characterization reflects our earlier remarks that doubt about the existence of others seems particularly hard, both in the respects that we're unable and willing to do it, and the respect that such doubt is emotionally disturbing. Broad is obviously right when he says that emotions are bound up with taking ourselves to be in a world of others. He's also onto something when he takes it to be important that in a world without others, it's not only that there would be no one for me to know, but there would be no one to whom I would be known. To contemplate a world without others is to contemplate a world in which our concern and interest in the other is a kind of absurd, humiliating, delusive activity. There's no one to take up my concern and interest for them. Broad enjoins us, however, to stifle our emotions and follow the argument whithersoever it may lead. But what if we don't stifle our emotions, but consider them instead as a rational resource by means of which we stand in relations to others? What if we argue, picking up from Duddington, that human affections would not be there to frustrate the demands of logic if other minds were not revealed in them? Two things have been notably missing from most contemporary analytical discussions of the problem of other minds. One are the emotional relations, as opposed to perceptions of emotions, between human beings are being largely ignored as potential epistemic resources. And two, the way in which others' minds figure in a person's consciousness of themselves have played little role in making sense of the sources by means of which we know others. So let us take a different tack in trying to make headway with our problem. The solipsist drives us back into our own self-consciousness, making us worry that the perceptual resources that he freely grants do not reach all the way to other minds. They just give us more knowledge of mere matter. Consider what happens if we stay firmly in the first-person introspective perspective and ask not, how can I reach into others' minds, but rather, how does the other reach into mine in a way that makes their mindedness palpable to me? One can sometimes get the impression from the philosophical treatment of it that the starting point for human beings in the task of coming to know the minds of others is an exercise in observational scrutiny and discrimination. Of all the material objects in the world, we have to develop ways of detecting those relatively few that are minded and learn to distinguish them from the rest. We need to sort out our parents and siblings from the perambulator's cots and bottles. However, things are quite the other way around. It's in being the object of observational scrutiny and practical attention that the mind of the other is first and most centrally impressed upon us. We do not seek out minds, they seek us out. Others' minds probe us with their attention through eye contact, verbal address, and touch, and in so doing, transform our experience of ourselves. I do not need to get out of my mind into another's to make contact with the mind of the other. The other already shows up in my experience of myself. We saw this in Duddington's description of our perception of suffering and pain. Part of directly experiencing the other's mind involved experience what's happening with me, my heart rings, and my world is blotted out. These are experiences of herself that the subject undergoes and knows through introspection, and which are imposed on her in her experience of the other. Introspection can reveal that my own mind is run through with forms of experience that relate to others. We may worry that the kind of cases Duddington appeals to rely on there already being effective relations in place between perceiver and subject. She says, after all, that it is love that means the pain of the loved one blots out one's world. We may also worry that appeal to love and pity involve us in an attentive focus on the other of a kind that's been lost when we're in the grip of solipsistic doubt. In the midst of our disturbance, we're somewhat like philosophical Capgra sufferers. There's a delusion where somebody thinks that their wife has been replaced by a machine or an alien, who ask themselves whether they've been left alone, scrutinizing whether they've been left alone. We're left scrutinizing other bodies, seeing, hearing, touching, looking for proof that they're persons, not realizing that it is precisely our capacity for effective resonance with others, and which has been set aside in the inquiry, that grounds our relations to them. However, here is a minimal kind of case that presupposes no partial and prior relations of love and pity, and in which the mind of another can be thought to impact on almost anyone, focusing only on themselves and capable of raising the solipsist's worry. Suppose you are sitting on a tube train reading your book. Suppose you notice someone looking at you, a quizzical expression on his face. You check their face. I made it gender neutral. You check they are actually looking at you. You follow their gaze. But no, it's definitely you they're looking at. When you try to look back to catch their eye, they swerve a little, only to come back to looking at you when they see your eyes go back to your book. You come to feel looked at, and you come to feel self-conscious. The human gaze produces an effective form of self-consciousness in you. When you come to feel self-conscious of yourself as the object of consciousness of the person looking at you, you may come to feel awkward or troubled. Or perhaps you can come to feel self-conscious in a kind of, you know, slightly pleasurable way. In any case, it has a phenomenological character. You come to be conscious of yourself as a material, voluminous thing, a thing with a front and a back. You come to be aware of having an outside. There might be a heightened awareness of your skin, your clothes, your externalities. If you speak or otherwise act, your experience of these productions tend to be duplex. You will experience them as their agent, but also as events in a world being observed by others. You come to have two perspectives, observed and observer, on yourself, held in a single self-conscious structure, where the observer's perspective comes to be embedded within the perspective of the observed. In short, noticing another's attentive look tends to transform one's experience of oneself. In provoking a response to a look in that way, the other has immediately and thereby differentiated themselves from other objects. The perambulator does not and cannot impinge on me in that way. We should not be surprised that this kind of self-consciousness is one core non-perceptual resource for knowing others. Effective forms of social self-consciousness, such as feeling self-conscious, feeling shame, pride, embarrassment, are precisely modes of experience that have the function of incorporating the view of another into an experience the subject has of herself. The form of the subject's self-consciousness is unintelligible in a world without others who are capable of taking her to be one way or another. Suppose it's agreed that others produce effective forms of self-consciousness in this way. How does it help with our problem? Well, we've identified a minimal way we have of standing in a relation of awareness to the other that goes beyond perception, and that anyone capable of worrying about our problem can appeal to. The effective forms of social self-consciousness offer a source of awareness of the other with a particular character. They're apt for incorporating the fact of another into my experience of myself, even when I've been brought back to myself feeling alone in the world. They subvert a natural bifurcation of domains, the subject relating her to herself only through introspection, and the public world, including others, knowable only through perception and inference. The subject, as it were, relates to the other through introspection. Through such forms of self-consciousness, the other, as we put it earlier, reaches into my mind and does so in a way that does not detach me from my own introspective connection to myself. In the midst of such self-consciousness, the existence of others as they insert themselves into my sense of myself is not in question, it's undeniable. It allows for, as Sartre thinks it must, if we are to know of the other's existence, a kind of social cogito. If the other's existence is not a vain conjecture or pure fiction, it's because there is something like a cogito that applies to it. A self-conscious subject capable of reflection asks herself whether she's able to doubt her own existence. She's unable. Why? She might reconstruct things, understanding them to go as follows. The little arguments I'm going to go through here are on the handout at the bottom, if that's helpful. First step of the argument, engagement in a particular act of conscious thinking. This is how I understand the cogito. Judgment, 2, I am thinking. Judgment, 3, I exist. A socially self-conscious subject who feels self-conscious, or shame, or pride, and is capable of reflection, asks herself whether she can doubt the existence of others. She's unable. Why? She might reconstruct things as follows. 1, engagement in seeing human eyes extendedly directed at me. Engagement in a feeling of self-consciousness, shame, pride, embarrassment. A judgment, the other is looking at me and has made me feel self-conscious. Judgment, 4, other minds exist. We might object to this way of trying to settle our doubts in a number of ways. Here are a few. I'll leave the rest to you. First, we may think that while it's really impossible to doubt one's own existence, we can doubt the existence of others. It's true that I am independent of any particular other and can exist without them, as death so miserably establishes. The claim, however, is that when I reflect on the nature of my self-conscious experience, I cannot doubt that there are others who transform me in these ways. Second, we may object that while it might be psychologically difficult, or even psychologically impossible, for a reflective, socially self-conscious subject to doubt the existence of others, we have shown it only to be a psychological impediment and not an epistemic one. Should we then implement Broad's injunction to stifle our emotions and go back to the argument? I think this is to understate the situation. The impediment is not like that of drinking nasty tasting medicine. Very hard, even psychologically impossible. The problem is rather that for a reflective subject capable of knowing her own mind, the forms of self-consciousness are unintelligible without a commitment to the other. The very structure of her self-consciousness, her understanding of the purpose of her emotional capacity she's exercising, builds in the possibility of being conditioned by the other. It's true that she might feel self-conscious without there being this particular other. She may be in error, or perhaps she's only imagining someone looking. But the nature of her capacity to feel self-conscious implies that the commitment, the existence of others has already been made. Moran, in his discussion of Sartre and the problem of other minds, captures beautifully a suggestion about the kind of relation we have to our problem. Quotes, "The problem of solipsism cannot be understood by the philosopher himself as either as a debate with an ordinary philosophical opponent or as an encounter with a madman, but rather as some kind of trouble with himself. The philosopher has to take himself to understand the path to solipsism well enough to get the problem started. He has to have the reef on which he's going to founder well enough in view to make sure to avoid it. But at the same time, he will not be satisfied simply to avoid it. Rather, his disquiet will not be relieved unless he can also say and show that the reef was never really there to begin with, because after all, he was never really tempted by madness. I think what a forced return by the look of the other to ordinary forms of social self-consciousness that are unintelligible without a commitment to the other give us is a sense of the dissolution of self, of madness, that it would take to sustain the solipsist's worry. And we are not mad after all. Third, it might be objected to my arguments in much the same way it is often in relation to the cogito, that A, that in the social cogito, we cannot argue our way to the knowledge of the existence of others, and B, that if we try to, our arguments will be question begging. The argument for the existence of others might be thought question begging at two points. First, we may ask, in line with Nagel's question in his discussion of Sartre, quotes, why doesn't the experience of the look depend on a logically prior grasp of the other rather than providing it without presuppositions? Two, we might argue that the judgment, the other is looking at me and has made me feel self-conscious, is only warranted if I understand the feeling of self-consciousness as due to the other. My response to this objection is to some extent to agree. The argument is not offered as an evidentially based proof of other minds. They're rather exercises in the articulation of the structure of human self-consciousness, possible if grounded in the thought of a subject who is self-conscious in the relevant way. They are able to remind the knower of the conditions of their self-consciousness that leaves them, as they are in that condition, no remaining question of whether there are other minds. It would be madness to doubt that there are. I want briefly, before ending, to say a little bit about what we might mean by experiencing a look. I phrase things in the reconstructed argument in a way that might allow that my seeing human eyes extendedly directed at me to not already involve my seeing the mind of anything in action. The eruption of self-consciousness as a result was treated as if it was the first contact with the mind of the other in the scenario. However, when presenting the scenario, I said, I then noticed someone's looking at me. What we take to be assumed or not assumed here will depend upon the matters discussed in the second section of the paper, whether seeing a looking is seeing a mental occurrence. Could we see mere moving matter look? Do I see minds in action when I see looking? Or is looking a mind-neutral activity? How one frames one's response to the solipsist about persons, how one settles a kind of trouble with oneself, as Moran puts it, will depend on how one thinks about lookings, talkings, frownings, and indeed looks of misery and cries of pain. If the solipsist has given us a capacious capacity for perception and a rich world of perceivables with a certain kind of metaphysics, you know, just to go, we can already know that there are minds when we see a look. The connection with effective forms of self-consciousness in so perceiving will enable us to understand why we care. And that's it.